From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to be a doctor, you go to medical school. You learn how to diagnose illness, how to wield a scalpel, and prescribe medicine. But what about compassion? Caring is at the heart of healing, but can it be learned? This hour, doctors share stories.
I suddenly saw that to inflict this kind of injury, you had to really think about it, and you had to really enjoy delivering that kind of suffering to that woman. And I turned and I vomited, and it was the only time during the genocide that I vomited. And she immediately understood, and she reached out and she touched my arm.
You can't have a high quality of life, I don't believe, unless you engage in compassionate activity. Because the Dalai Lama said over and over again, when you do something good for someone else, they get benefit and you get benefit too.
Interestingly, there are business seminars and schools that teach empathy and compassion because they recognize this as a key to success.
Like a lot of family physicians, Zorba Pastor spends his days seeing patients with everything from diabetes to ear infections. He's also a practicing Buddhist who volunteers his time and medical services in northern India with a community of Tibetan exiles. And he's also a personal physician to the Dalai Lama. Pastor told Ann Strangchamps how his spiritual life shapes his medical practice.
What really impressed me about Buddhism is that there really are two issues when it comes to health and wellness. And I saw that really when I entered medical school a few years later. You have the science issue on one hand, and then you have really kind of the compassion issue, the warmth issue, the heart issue, on the other hand. So you have the physiological heart, but then you have the real heart and soul. And to me, they're both necessary to achieve optimal wellness.
That's really lovely. So can you kind of flesh that out a bit? I mean, does that mean that for most medical conditions, you feel that there's almost a heart or felt component as well as the scientific component?
I'll give you the perfect example. In the 70s, Western medicine had captured childbirth. So when I went to medical school, every woman got an IV. Everyone got twilight sleep, scopolamine, thorazine, and morphine. Every woman was strapped to the table when she delivered the baby with leather so she wouldn't soil the child. And that was Western medicine. That was the ideal. Well, it was clear that wasn't the ideal, but that was scientific medicine, a lot of it unproven, but scientific medicine. And then what ultimately changed is women deliver babies completely differently. And believe me, that was not based on the fact that physicians wanted to make changes.
It
was
based on the physicians fact wanted to be kinder and gentler.
Not at all. Not at all. It was consumer driven. But when I looked at that scientific aspect, we'll say of childbirth, I thought it was just awful. And I was a young medical student. I didn't know how to change it, but I knew it was bad. And ultimately, there have been lots of changes in medicine, and we still have a long way to go.
So what would be a comparable issue today? Is there something that's, you know, sort of front and center for you where you think, no, that is just
wrong? Give you a really good comparable issue of how medicine has changed today. So my wife, Penny, recently had surgery. She had bypass surgery and then had an aortic valve surgery, big surgery, which was just really, really hard. You want science there. You want science there, the best science you can, great surgeon and everything. She's in the ICU, and out in the hallway, there's a person with a dog, and it's a dog, which is a companion dog that they go around to various people. And my wife loves dogs, and he said, "Do you want us to come in the room?" And I said, "Sure." And she's kind of out of it post surgically, not fully with it. And she looks at the dog and smiles and goes, "Yes, that's touchy feely warmth stuff." Mm-hmm. That stuff was not a double blind placebo controlled trial that was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and you need both to reach optimal wellness.
Well, for these changes to take place, I know there has to have been some hard science suggesting that this is a good idea, bringing dogs into the CCU. Because 10, 15 years ago, if you'd asked, the chief surgeon, is okay if we bring a dog in here?
Oh, they would say it's awful. Oh, absolutely.
Right.
I think sometimes what happens is science follows consumerism. That's what it is. Mm. Somebody may have said, hey, let's see if dogs are okay for patients. But I don't think it started that way. I think hospitals competed with one another for patients to have people in the hospital. And then somebody said, hey, why don't we have a dog service in the hospital? And people thought it was a good idea. So I don't think it was scientifically driven. Mm. And I think that's really where the compassionate aspects of medicine come in. Doctors and scientists are, they have their scientific hat involved. They don't have their most do not have their warm, fuzzy feeling hat involved.
You also have been at various times, I think, a physician for the Dalai Lama?
Right. I first met His Holiness, my wife Penny and I first met His Holiness in 1975. And so I've been involved with his health care. And we go out once a year to Rochester, to Mayo Clinic, great institution. And he gets his executive physical up in Rochester. And then I've been involved with his health care. I go to India every year. I've been involved with the hospital of the Tibetan government in exile, you know, help fund that hospital, gathering money for that hospital, improving the health care. So, yes, yeah, I get to be involved with that.
Are you his main physician?
His main physician is Dr. Sen. He's the man. He's the main person. He's been his main doctor for a couple of decades. Yeah. But I help him. So yeah. I'm really the contact person in the U.S. I'm the go-to person in the U.S. when His Holiness is in the U.S. And I try to make sure that his health care is maintained. And then I work with His Holiness and with Dr. Sen. But I would say I'm the second string. I'm covering Dr. Sutton's back, to use the sports motif. That's right.
Well, not to, you know, trespass on doctor-patient confidentiality, but for you, I mean, what is it like to treat a human being who so many people regard as holy?
Well, it's a holy experience. That's probably the way to say it, to be able to sit there when we go up to Mayo, we sit there and we have a bunch of physicians that we are, and I'm with Dr. Sutton, and we go in with each and every physician, so I get a chance to sort of see how the Dalai Lama thinks about things, and just being around there, and he thinks about things, he weighs evidence like everyone else. I mean, that's what he says. This isn't HIPAA confidential information. He looks and makes decisions himself, just like all of us do. But to just sort of look at his decision-making process helps me, because I look at how he looks at things. And for him, what the physician's heart is like is as important as what his scientific acumen is like. Mm-hmm. So when I went up to Mayo initially and did sort of pre-interviews of physicians, and then Dr. Sutton and I went up to Mayo and then interviewed physicians, what I was looking for is somebody who had a good head scientifically and had a good heart. And that was extremely important.
How do you tell?
Well, first of all, you know, we in the West go, well, often with surgeons, well, they have no bedside manner, but they're good at their hands. You know, you've probably heard things like that. Well, that isn't going to fly. He doesn't want someone like that. In fact, it shouldn't fly with us as consumers of medical care. You know, if somebody is not nice to us or doesn't have the time of day for us and doesn't have a bedside manner, why should we accept them as our physician?
No, now, why would you want somebody operating on your body if you
not
don't
all.
Feel that they
of
can
course.
Connect
Absolutely.
With you as a human being?
Of course. We don't want to do that. Now, if they're the only person in town, that's a different issue then. Mm-hmm. But in medicine today, more often than not, you have a choice and you want to pick somebody who's nice and friendly and considerate. That was really a very primary issue.
But I guess one of the things I'm kind of curious about is it simply if you look for somebody with a good heart or an open heart, are you looking for somebody simply nice, or is there something subtler you're looking for?
No, I think you have a sixth sense for that. Yeah. You know, you're talking to somebody, you have a sixth sense. I use mine. Now, it might be wrong, but I would use what we may call sixth sense, which really isn't. It's really the intuitive nature that we have is really based on past experiences. And so, you know, when we interviewed a number of people. We went to a number of institutions. We went to Stanford and Mayo and Hopkins, and then His Holiness chose Mayo. But we interviewed some very nice people. And then there were some people that I interviewed, and I thought, I don't think this is the right person. Mm-hmm. And then Dr. Sutton came prior to, and then he interviewed people, and then he made decisions. And sometimes his decision wasn't the same as mine, and then we had to figure out whose was right.
Boy, I bet everybody listening is thinking, I wish somebody would do that for me.
Right.
Come around and choose
right.
my physicians.
Have somebody choose their physicians. And then we chose, we were pretty good. We were about at the 90% range, but we weren't at the 100% range. Mm-hmm. You know, afterwards, His Holiness told Sutton what he thought of some of the physicians, and some he really, you know, they were all very, very good, and they were all very kind. Everyone really went out of their way
to
be
sure.
nice.
It's the Dalai Lama.
So they're stepping up to the plate, doing their best, and so we did a good job.
So as a practicing physician, if you were to talk with people about, in general, what makes a good and healthy life, I would imagine some form of compassionate practice.
Absolutely. There's a physical aspect.
Might be one of your
recommendations. There's a mental aspect. There's a compassionate aspect. And you can't have a high quality of life, I don't believe, unless you engage in compassionate activity. Because the Dalai Lama said over and over again, when you do something good for someone else, they get benefit and you get benefit too. And the good you do can just be, hello, how are you, in a genuine way when you're picking up a newspaper or paying for your gas in the morning. And I started doing this a number of years ago. Whenever I get gas and I go in, I may be getting some milk or something else, and I'll say, how are you doing, to the person at the cash register. And the first response is, I'm fine. And it's on automatic. I haven't engaged with the person at all. Mm-hmm. And I'll look at them again, and they're usually working, you know, giving me change or running my charge card through. And I'll say, no, how's your life today? And immediately they step 100% of the time. Pretty much, maybe not 100, maybe 99. They step out of what they're doing. They'll look at me and they'll go, yeah, today's a good day. Or they'll say, it's kind of hairy. But we actually then engage in a conversation. I know I've touched that person. And we both stepped out for a second. It makes us feel good. When you touch people, they feel good, you feel good, everyone benefits. The overall happiness increases in the world and we have less war.
Zorba Pastor is a physician, co-host of Zorba Pastor on Your Health, and the author of The Longevity Code. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. As a pediatrician in Madison, Wisconsin, Susan Ehrlich is used to treating illness and diagnosing the sick. She's had less practice standing by when the news is painful. And she's not the doctor, but part of the patient's family.
My father never really wanted me to be a doctor. I think he wanted me to be an art teacher who married a Jewish doctor. So when I became the Jewish doctor who married a WASP civil rights attorney, he was gracious and accepting, but I always thought I saw a hint of disappointment in his eyes. I was in my first semester of medical school when my father, at age 55, had his first heart attack. I remember weeping silently in the darkened airline cabin when I flew the red-eye to be with him and my family, hoping I would make it in time to say goodbye. My first year medical school classes hadn't prepared me for seeing him comatose and intubated. But they had taught me that older doctors love to teach younger ones. One of the first things everyone learns is the adage, see one, do one, teach one. In other words, observe a procedure, perform the procedure, then teach the procedure. When my father's cardiologist found out I was a med student, he pulled me aside and started explaining all the lines and squiggles on my father's EKG. If this happens, it would cause this, he explained cheerfully, but if that happens, well, that's the ball game. The voice in my head was screaming, this is not a ball game. This is my father's life. But the intimidated medical student thanked him for taking the time to teach me. We all thought my father would be dead within days, but the next day, he received a visit from his secretary at the university where he was a history professor, who said in his presence, he can't die, he hasn't finished his book. Damned if he wasn't awake and alert and extubated, talking and eating by the next day. And that's the way it went for the next 30 years. We'd joke about how Dad was the Energizer Bunny, who would be on the edge of death, everyone would be hanging black crepe, and he would bounce right back when he realized his work wasn't quite finished. I don't even know how many heart attacks he had, and he ended up in chronic congestive heart failure with a pacemaker and a defibrillator, not to mention all the battery changes, but he just wasn't going to stop. Eventually, though, my father decided that he didn't want to keep going to the hospital after his cardiac events, didn't want to keep having invasive procedures done, and that it was time to call in hospice. By that time, he had finished the third book of his 3-volume history series. So the pacemaker and the defibrillator were turned off, and he was ready. But true to form, he lived another year, and his mind remained completely sharp. Then one day I got the phone call that he'd had another heart attack, the big one. Yet by the time I arrived, about 6 hours later, he was once again sitting up and talking and joking. The hospice nurse thought he would probably die within about 2 weeks, but not right then. and my father got on the phone and called his buddies around the country to say goodbye. But late that night, he began having severe chest pain and difficulty breathing. Hospice had already provided oral morphine for pain, but he had always been a very picky eater, and he hated its bitter taste. So I called his doctor, and because I was a physician, I was allowed to administer the morphine with an injection. His doctor had syringes and medication sent right over by cab, and by the time they arrived, my father was in extreme pain. So I began to give him the morphine to help him relax and breathe easier and be more comfortable. He was fighting so hard to breathe that he couldn't talk. But then, in the midst of the pain and the morphine and the sadness, I saw him look at me. The look told me what I needed to know, that he was glad I was a doctor, so that I could give him that one final gift. Within 2 hours, he had died. I like to think that he was proud of me. Now I'm the teacher, and I'm working with a group of first-year med students and struggling with how to help them become compassionate doctors. I've decided there's no way to teach that. All I can do is help them listen to their own narratives and learn from their own lives so that they give every patient and every family the respect and humility and wisdom they deserve, and then to thank their patients every day for the extraordinary privilege of being allowed to be part of their stories.
Susan Ehrlich has been a practicing pediatrician for 30 years. I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up next, a doctor remembers his time on the ground during the Rwandan genocide. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you're looking for the model of a compassionate doctor, you could start with James Orbinski. As a former member and president of Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, he's served in some of the world's most chaotic places, like Somalia, the refugee camps of Afghanistan, and Rwanda, both before and during the genocide. He writes about his experiences in the book An Imperfect Offering. He told Steve Paulson about the moment he realized what he, as a doctor, was capable of.
One day in a small clinic up in northern Rwanda, I was inserting feeding tubes in through the noses and down into the bellies of several small children. And I was doing this because the kids were starving. And one of the children pulled out the feeding tube, and I went to reinsert the feeding tube. And as I did that, she became extremely upset and screaming because it's quite painful. And I just stopped to give her a moment. And as I stopped, I remember looking out the window and seeing the most beautiful, green, lush, fertile land. Every shade of green that you could possibly imagine was there. It was absolutely a glorious image. And I thought, there's something wrong with this picture, with this scene, this moment that I'm in. This is the most fertile land on the continent of Africa, which it is. And yet, on this very land, these children are starving. Why? And I asked the question, why? And it soon became apparent that people were cash cropping, growing tea and coffee, and that this was a consequence of World Bank and IMF monetary policies that were designed to restructure the economy of Rwanda. And the consequence of that was that there was significant starvation in many parts of the country. And there were other consequences that, for example, user fees were introduced to clinics and to schools and so on. And so more and more kids were unable even to get medical care unless their parents were able to pay for it. And so that experience, and that's just an example, that experience of trying to provide medical care and confronting the political causes and conditions that create the suffering that you're trying to address led me to a reevaluation, if you will, of what I could be and what I could do as a physician. And from there, I joined MSF.
You were no longer going to pursue the academic track. You were going to devote yourself towards humanitarian causes.
That's right. And from there, I joined Doctors Without Borders. Myself and a group of friends, we started a chapter here in Canada, and then I began working internationally with MSF.
Is it clear to you what it means to be a humanitarian, especially if you're a doctor? Is sort of the overall philosophy right there in front of you?
The answer to that question has changed for me over the course of my career. When I first started working as a putative humanitarian, I believed that humanitarian assistance, medical humanitarian assistance, should be completely independent of politics, and that it is completely independent of politics and political choices. And I naively believed that. And now, some 20-plus years later, I see that it's inextricably linked to politics. And the choices about who gets humanitarian assistance and who doesn't, these are political choices. And yet, for me as a human being, not as a political being, but as a human being, I feel, recognize, and see the dignity, literally, of another human being. And if that other human being is suffering in a way where they cannot act to relieve their own suffering, then as a human being, I have a strong need to respond to that.
You went on to work in a number of very difficult situations in Peru, in Afghanistan, in all kinds of dire circumstances. Then you went back to Rwanda during the genocide in 1994. And to put this in perspective, this was a period when a million Tutsis were killed in just 14 weeks, I mean butchered by clubs and machetes. You went right back into that. What was that like for you?
Well, it was brutal, Stephen. I mean, it was literally brutal. It was really the most important turning point in my life to realize what genocide is, what it looks like, what it smells like, how it is the final political crime.
It's the systematic effort to totally wipe out an entire group of people.
Exactly. And in Rwanda, it was a state-planned, rationally implemented plan to completely eliminate the Tutsi people from the country of Rwanda. It was planned for many years. It was systematically implemented over a short period of time. Despite the best efforts of Major General Romeo Dallaire, who was the UN force commander in Rwanda at that time, the international community failed to respond to a genocide. And France, Belgium, and the United States primarily knowingly pursued their foreign policies through a genocide. And each of those countries, and many more, but those three countries primarily, knew that the genocide was taking place and blocked efforts at the UN Security Council to send reinforcements to help the UN force that was present in Rwanda at the time. And so in the face of literally the streets, and I mean literally, running red with blood, in the face of a million people murdered, massacred in mass graves across the country, in the face of the egregious political malfeasance and political failure that meant that there was no military intervention to stop the genocide, that fundamentally altered my worldview. And it wasn't an intellectual experience. You know, it's not something that you read about. It's something that I lived.
When you were in Rwanda, confronted by this just unspeakable horror, you also write about some amazing moments. I mean, for instance, you suddenly found in front of you in one of the hospitals you were working at or these sort of makeshift health clinics a woman who'd been mutilated, and yet she showed remarkable courage. And you talk about how she basically tried to calm you.
That particular woman, she was one of 600 casualties one particular day who were laid out on the streets outside the hospital. There were so many people that day who were brought to the hospital because of gunshot injuries, machete injuries, landmine injuries, and so on. And she had both of her ears cut off. She'd had both of her breasts cut off. Her Achilles tendons had been cut. And she had a carefully cut pattern of slashes laid into her face. And I remember trying to look after her and give her a few sutures to stop the major bleeding. And then I would have to move on to the next patient and the next patient and the next patient. But I remember looking at her, and suddenly it wasn't simply, I wasn't there simply as a technician, as a medical technician, a person providing sutures for life-threatening sutures. But I suddenly saw that to inflict this kind of injury, you had to really think about it. And you had to really enjoy delivering that kind of suffering to that woman. I remember looking at her and suddenly just being overwhelmed by what she had experienced. And I turned and I vomited. And it was the only time during the genocide that I vomited. And she immediately understood what was happening to me. And she reached out and she touched my arm very gently. And she said in Kinyarwanda, Umara, Umara Shah. Now, Shah is a Rwandan word meaning my friend. And Umara is a Rwandan word meaning courage. Have courage. Find your courage. And that's what she said to me. Now, she was lying in the middle of the road, suffering in the most profound way. And yet she responded to my dissonance, to my disruption, to what I was feeling. And after I had sutured a few of her arteries, the ones that were bleeding significantly, and that were they not sutured, she would have died. After I had finished, there were many more cuts that needed to be closed, but she could see that there were many, many more patients. And nurses were calling me for the next patient, the next patient, the next patient, and she told me to go. She said, "Ale, ale, Umara Shah, go." And she knew exactly what I was experiencing and what I was feeling. And she told me to go on to the next patient. And I think in many ways that story encapsulates the beauty, if you will, of what we can be as human beings, even in the most egregious of circumstances.
Do you know what eventually happened to her?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
One of the things that really struck me as I was reading your book was the friendship that you've had with a Catholic monk named Benedict, and you were raised a Catholic yourself. And I guess when you were a boy, he had some advice for you. He said, "There is no escape, James. There is only what you do." Do you consider yourself a spiritual person?
Well, I do, but I'm not a religious person. I think what I have come to know over my lifetime thus far is, in the simplest of terms, my own smallness in the world, that the world has existed long before me and will exist long after me. And I am here for a limited period of time, and I am in a very particular place and in a very particular moment in this cosmos and in this thing that we call life. And I'm part of it. I'm part of this beauty, this yearning that seeks after itself, this thing that we call life. And I'm here now, and I live with that knowledge, with that seeing. And I think it gives me a certain clarity to have some sense of boundary in my play or around my place in the world. And I think, for lack of a better description, I would describe that as a spiritual beginning, one that is humble in the face of the world, its past and its present and its future, and that recognizes my own ability to respond and to be responsible for life and all of its beauty.
James Orbinski accepted the Nobel Peace Prize for Doctors Without Borders in 1999. He's now a co-founder of Dignitas International, a medical humanitarian organization. Steve Paulson spoke with Orbinski about his memoir, An Imperfect Offering. Danielle Ofri is a practicing physician today. Her most recent book is Medicine in Translation. She's also an associate professor of medicine at New York University and editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review. It's a life she owes in part to mentors like Joseph Sitkin, who taught her as a resident. But sometimes happy endings elude both patients and their doctors. In her essay, Intensive Care, from the book Writer MD, she describes her time as a young doctor and the emotional price that can come with a license to practice medicine.
The patient was a routine alcoholic hauled off the streets of Manhattan on a warm June evening. When his dose of Thunderbird wore off, he slid into alcohol withdrawal. The ER staff gave him 10 milligrams of Valium to stop the shakes, then 20, then 40. They'd been unable to calm the tremors at even the highest doses of Valium and so started giving him barbiturates, the big guns. Eventually, they did silence his tremors and, in the process, his breathing. So by the time he arrived in our ICU, he was intubated with a breathing tube down his throat and a heaving ventilator at his side. Dr. Sitkin, our lanky 6-foot attending, slouched against the IV pole as the intern presented the case, a derisive half-smile on his face. "Geez," he said in a slow Tennessee drawl, "where do they unearth these ER docs? It's like hauling in a John Deere tractor to knock off a pesky moth. This guy ain't going to be whistling Dixie for some time. This guy ain't going to wake up this week." His hands began to gesticulate in the air. "This guy ain't going to wake up this month. This guy ain't going to wake up until at least Rosh Hashanah." He pointed to the ventilator. "In fact, why don't we just park a shofar on this old ventilator? When he starts blowing the shofar, we'll know it's time to extubate him." I didn't want to do it again, but the image of our homeless alcoholic blowing the ram's horn in bed 12 of the ICU was too much. To my embarrassment and annoyance, I once again found myself laughing uncontrollably on rounds with Dr. Sitkin. His humor was off-color, inappropriate, and insulting, but the combination of his dry Jewish wit and his Southern drawl overpowered my self-control.
What was it like to learn from someone like that? That's extraordinary.
It was a little bit intimidating and frightening. At one point in the story, I talk about I was confused about which antibiotic to give a patient who had spiked another fever, so I thought, I'll call him. He's an infectious disease specialist, so I called him. He was in his office. And when I told him what I wanted, he said, "Well, why don't you just grow up and, you know, figure out your own antibiotics? You know, you don't need me to give you a kindergarten lesson in antibiotics." So he could be very harsh if he thought that what you were asking was below his level or what you should already know.
But it wasn't as though he didn't care, was it?
Not at all. Now, we had one patient, as I write about in the story, this young woman who had leukemia that flared up after she gave birth. She was a young woman with a 4-day-old baby, and we would spend our entire time on this patient because she really had a chance and a life ahead of her. And he spent all of his efforts, and it was clear how much he cared. He had young children himself, and he would always look at the photo, the Polaroid photo of the baby, whenever we went on rounds.
He was so hard on the rounds that you did, but there has to have been another time when people saw a softer side. You talked about this patient with leukemia, the young mother. She did eventually die. How did he take it?
He was quiet. And for the first time, he wasn't cracking jokes. He wasn't making, you know, witty comments. He just paused, and you could see him really absorbing it. And then he said, "You guys did an excellent job." Just that one line, and we knew those words meant something. He would never say it if he didn't mean it.
So this year you spent with Dr. Sitkin was incredibly important to you, but you moved on. And then you found him again, only by this time it was a whole different story. You saw a poster of Dr. Sitkin when you were traveling through the airport?
I graduated. I was away from the university for about a half a year. I'd been on vacation, and I'd come back, and I saw You know, those missing posters on the people put on the phone booths. You know, and I saw one. It was some kid who got drunk at a party and disappeared. And I thought these are really people. And so the next poster I saw a block later, I thought, let me go up and look at it. And there was Dr. Sitkin's face on the poster, missing. I've never seen a face on a missing poster that I knew, and it seemed unreal. And I had been out of town, so I quickly called some friends. They said, oh, yes, he's been missing for almost a week now. And there were all kinds of rumors. Maybe he went out to his country house. Maybe he's had a breakdown. Nobody knew where he went. And it was a terrible, frightening feeling that someone I was connected with, even in a small way. And it turns out there was a note on his computer chronicling his despondency and increasing despair. And when I read that, the New York Times was following the story because he was a very prominent physician. I couldn't imagine how this person, who always had a joke and a thing to say that was funny, could be a person of despair. And a man who spoke so lovingly of his young daughters, where this despair came from.
You wrote about this in the piece. In fact, would you read the piece you wrote about him at that point in his life?
So he was missing for about 2 weeks. On January 29th, a body washed ashore. A badly decomposed body was found under the George Washington Bridge, the New York Times read, tentatively identified as that of Dr. Joseph Sitkin, a prominent Manhattan doctor who disappeared 2 weeks ago and left a note chronicling his despondency. I close my eyes, unable to read on. How much must his heart have ached as his palm rested upon the frigid metal handrail of the bridge? With how much despair must his legs have trembled as he eased over the edge? How much anguish must he have possessed to face down the furious river? Ours is a dangerous profession, I've often thought. For every Dr. Sitkin who declares his pain to the world, there are 50 others who suffer silently, for whom the anguish burns slowly and excruciatingly. The medical profession has little room or patience for hearing about this. We doctors are always trying to help our patients to get beyond their denial, but it seems that we use it the most for ourselves. Is that the Faustian bargain we make when we enter the profession? I don't want to believe that is true, but for some it apparently is.
It obviously wasn't his intention, but in a way he was still teaching at the end of his life, wasn't he?
I think he was, in a most painful way, and I think about his lesson all the time, and it keeps me on the lookout for signs of depression, anxiety, stress among my students and my colleagues, because he really didn't let on to anyone. It was completely cloaked in his constant humor and cackling wit.
Of course, this isn't unique to him. There is a price that every physician has to pay. How do most doctors deal with it?
Well, I think we all have many different ways, and I think there's two issues here. One is how we deal with the stress and emotions of our profession. That's one issue. A separate issue is having an illness of depression. They're not one and the same, but they can coexist. Certainly, doctors have a higher suicide rate than many other professions. And so I think there is some interrelationship, but I do think he had an illness that was separate from the everyday stress that we go under. Nevertheless, the stresses we face do compound in us. And I think for many of us, it's finding other outlets, whether it be families, other hobbies and passions. And for many people, it's cutting back on our hours and finding a little bit more time to live our lives outside of medicine. And the rise of part-time medicine is something that's relatively new. It didn't exist 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. What would you tell a new doctor now, how to practice medicine, about compassion, how to stay emotionally whole?
Well, I would advise them to be real with their emotions. And that is to really recognize when things are sad, as they often are, that being sad is the normal human response. To hide that is to really harm ourselves. And may not be crying openly with your patients, though some physicians feel comfortable. But at some point, one has got to cry when something is sad. And when you're angry, to also face that emotion, whether it be with a colleague or even sometimes with a patient or with your own therapist or with your spouse, that we can't keep hiding our emotions. Eventually, they will come back to us.
Daniel Ofri is the author of the essay Intensive Care, which appears in the book Writer MD. She's a practicing physician and the editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to learn more about the guests, books, and music featured on our program, stop by our website, ttbook.org. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Andrew Weil is one of the most influential voices in alternative medicine today. He's credited with establishing the field of integrative medicine and is the author of several best-selling books. In his latest, Spontaneous Happiness, Weil talks about living a life that promotes happiness and peace of mind. It's a compassionate recipe for personal well-being, without the pressure to be happy all the time. Weil told Steve Paulson that he's dubious about the prevalence of medically managed depression.
Well, I think all you have to do is watch the commercials on television. I think the pharmaceutical industry has been very effective at convincing people that ordinary states of sadness are matters of imbalance of brain biochemistry that needs treatment. I don't believe that. And also, I think our moods are supposed to vary. We're not supposed to be high and happy all the time. I think it's normal to experience lows, not incapacitating lows, but I think that's part of human experience. And there's even some new thinking from the field of evolutionary psychology that depression may serve a purpose and that evolution may have selected this as a trait because it's characterized by inward focus and a process called depressive rumination, usually thought of as pathological, in which one chews over the same thoughts over and over. But in fact, that inward focus and that tendency to ruminate may facilitate problem solving and may help us tap into creative thinking. So I'm not so sure that the goal is to make the lows go away all the time.
You talk about something called cytokines as one factor here. Can you explain this?
Yes. This is an interesting story. Farmers have long known that when domestic animals become sick, usually with infectious diseases, they exhibit a characteristic pattern of behavioral changes called sickness behavior. These include loss of appetite, loss of mobility, lack of interest in sex, lack of interest in socializing with others of their kind. These changes are strikingly similar to the changes of humans with major depression. Farmers have traditionally attributed the sickness behavior to fatigue associated with illness. But in the 1950s, it was found that it was mediated by a blood-borne factor. You can take blood from an animal with sickness behavior, inject it into a healthy animal, it shows the same changes. Nobody knew what this was. It was called Factor X. In the 1970s, it was found to be cytokines, which are a group of regulatory proteins used by the immune system to regulate inflammation. They include things like interferon and the interleukins and tumor necrosis factor. In the 1970s, some of these became available in pure form for medical usage. Interferon, for example, became available as a treatment for chronic hepatitis. One of the prominent side effects of interferon therapy is severe depression, even suicide, and there are great warnings about this on the package labels. So this has led to what's called the cytokine hypothesis of depression, which is an alternative to the serotonin hypothesis. It sounds right to me. I think there's accumulating evidence for it. The fact is, in depression, there's a correlation between inflammation and upregulation of cytokine-mediated inflammation and depression. What causes what is not clear, but there's a definite correlation. And this suggests that an anti-inflammatory diet and lifestyle is protective of mental health. And there's even a recent suggestion, some papers have come out in the past year, suggesting trying anti-inflammatory drugs as novel treatments for depression.
Now, you've had some personal struggles with depression, haven't you?
In my 20s, 30s, and 40s, I suffered from what would be called dysthymic disorder, which is the technical term for mild to moderate depression. I don't have that anymore, and I think you know, some of that may be the result of getting older, but I think it's mostly due to the cumulative effect of lifestyle changes that I've made.
So what are some of these lifestyle changes?
The first is making sure that I get regular physical activity. I try to be physically active every day. The evidence for the effect of exercise to both prevent and treat depression is as great as that for antidepressant medication. I have also changed my diet. I eat the anti-inflammatory diet that I teach others to follow. Very interesting connection between inflammation and depression recently come to light. Basic rule of that diet is to avoid refined, processed, and manufactured food. That's simple.
You're a big advocate of the Mediterranean diet, right?
Yes, and the anti-inflammatory diet that I've developed is a version of the Mediterranean diet that's tweaked to make it even more effective. I supplement my diet with fish oil, and again, the evidence we have for the benefits of omega-3 fatty acid supplementation is as great as that for antidepressant medication. I also take vitamin D, and there's a clear association with vitamin D deficiency and depression. I advise everyone to get their vitamin D levels checked and then to correct that. So those are some basic things on the physical level. I also then look at approaches to enhancing emotional wellness by retraining the mind. I think that's a challenge. It's obvious that to me that a lot of sadness, anxiety, comes from our thoughts. And managing thought is not so easy. There are methods that come from Western psychology. I think the newer techniques like cognitive behavioral therapy are very, very effective and much more time and cost efficient than older forms of psychotherapy.
I know there has been some study of monks and nuns who meditate or pray and you know, whether this seems to translate into contentment and serenity. And it sounds like you're suggesting that they're doing something right.
To me, the most exciting and profound finding that's coming out of this work is that changing the ways we think and the ways that we use the mind can actually change the function and eventually the structure of the brain. That is a revolution in thinking, because in the biomedical model, the arrows of cause and effect flow in one direction. It's from physical reality to mental function. So it's brain biochemistry disturbances that cause disturbances in emotion. This new research is showing that if you retrain your mind, if you think differently, this changes the function and, as I said, eventually the physical structure of the brain. That's very exciting.
You're saying that this mind-body approach that you've been talking about for years now, it's not just tweaking what we know about the way the mind works, the way the body works, the way medicine works. It's a radical challenge to the status quo.
Absolutely. And I think this really points the way to a paradigm shift away from the biomedical model toward what I would call the integrative model of mental health and of medicine in general. Last year, the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, which I direct, sponsored the first national conference on integrative mental health in Phoenix. We had planned to have about 300 mental health professionals there, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and so forth. We ended up with 700, and if we'd had a bigger venue, we could have had twice that number. The hunger in this group for other ways of doing things was so great. I mean, people are tired of simply dispensing drugs as much as patients are, I think, tired of taking them. And there are so many other options out there. You know, I've mentioned some of them, but I haven't even gotten to the, you know, what I'd call the spiritual category of interventions, secular spirituality and things that we could do to enhance mood. One of the things I discovered in researching the book, which surprised me, was the amount of scientific evidence we have for the power of gratitude to enhance mood. Simply feeling grateful and expressing gratitude are very effective. There's an exercise that comes from the field of positive psychology, keeping a gratitude journal. You get a little notebook, keep it by your bedside. During the day, you make mental notes of things you have to be grateful for. When you go to bed, you jot these down. Doing that for 1 week can produce enhancement of mood that lasts for 6 months.
Hmm. Let me follow up on this idea of what you call secular spirituality. What do you mean by this?
I mean attending to the non-physical dimension of your life without reference to a deity, to the supernatural, to sacred books, to things that are contrary to rationality or scientific knowledge. And I'm a great believer in this, in the integrative medicine that I teach. Spirituality is a subject that we teach physicians in training. This, you know, this includes everything from thinking about the effect of being in nature to having relationships with companion animals, to the relationships you have with other people, to how other people's moods affect you, to practicing forgiveness, to feeling and expressing gratitude, as I just described. I think there's a whole range of topics that come under this heading that I would call secular spirituality.
Now, another thing that you talk about as being important is compassion, acting compassionately. And it's interesting to think about this because, I mean, I think everyone knows that this is a good thing to do. I mean, it's one of the foundations of every world religion. But you're saying it's not just that it helps other people. It helps ourselves to be compassionate.
Definitely. And a closely related concept is empathy, that it, both of these are about feeling what others feel and then behaving appropriately. Empathy is recognized as a key to business success. And interestingly, there are business seminars and schools that teach empathy and compassion because they recognize this as a key to success. This is also one of the things being researched in the neuroscientific studies that are looking at advanced meditators, Tibetan monks. In Buddhism, there are practices to enhance compassion, forms of meditation to do this. And we are able to document, again, changes in the brain, both physically and in brain function, that correlate with this kind of training. And this also, practice at this, seems to produce greater contentment, serenity, resilience, you know, all the qualities that I think are essential to emotional well-being.
Andrew Weil is a leading champion of integrative medicine. He's the author of numerous books, including Spontaneous Happiness. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website, ttbook.org, where you'll also find a wealth of past interviews with great thinkers, creators, and instigators. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Medicine and Compassion. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Doug Gordon, Ann Strainchamps, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.